You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, public radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today my focus is on an institution that you've all probably heard of, and it plays a major role in everyone's life, but perhaps many are maybe unsure of what exactly it does, who runs it, and who it's accountable to. That institution is called the Federal Reserve Board, and it's the subject of an important new book just written by my guest today. The book is called The Lords of Easy Money, How the Federal Reserve Broke the American Economy, and the author is Christopher Leonard, who's a business reporter whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Fortune, and Bloomberg News Business Week. He's also written a couple other books called Cokeland and The Meat Racket. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to be on today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's this institution is opaque. We hear about it, and probably a lot of folks that really understand the inner workings of government are aware of it. But can you start just by saying kind of what the mission of the Federal Reserve is, and then kind of how it's kind of the mission creep has increased, and as a way of starting out talking about your book?
Absolutely. And the fact that this institution is so, I just feel like it's little understood. It feels like it's this very technical institution that doesn't affect our lives. But the whole reason I wrote this book is, as a business reporter, I realized what the Federal Reserve has done over the last decade has really changed our economy in fundamental ways. And what the Fed has done, it helps explain this, frankly, bizarre economy we live in, where wage earners have been just really struggling to keep up over the last decade, at least, with wages being stagnant. You know, overall economic growth has been stagnant, productivity growth has been stagnant. But we see these certain markets just overheated. We see stock markets breaking records every day. Corporate debt markets are breaking records. Wall Street is just literally making more money than it can handle right now. And the Federal Reserve helps explain all of this. So at the root core, the Federal Reserve is our central bank. We created it. Congress created it in 1913, and it created the Fed to do two simple things. The first is to create and manage our currency. That thing we call a dollar is actually a Federal Reserve note. So that's an important job. The Fed is the only institution in the world that can create new dollars out of thin air. And then secondly, the Fed was supposed to be kind of a safety stop or a safety net for our banking system. It was supposed to be the so-called lender of last resort that could step in and print money in the case of a bank panic to help otherwise healthy banks. Now, the reason I wrote this book is to help explain the Fed's activity since 2010. And that really is a turning point moment in history in late 2010 when the Federal Reserve embarked on a wildly experimental program to drive American prosperity through money printing. And what I mean by that is that for a decade during the 2010s, the Federal Reserve pinned the interest rate, the banking interest rate, they pinned it at zero for over 7 years, which is a radical departure from the past. Interest rates were usually 3-4% in history. The Fed pinned them at zero for a decade. And then at the same time, while interest rates were so low, the Fed pumped trillions of dollars into the Wall Street banking system through an experimental program called quantitative easing, which I can explain. But the long and short of it is the Fed printed more money between 2008 and 2014 than it had printed ever before. In fact, it printed about three times as much money during this period as it had printed during its whole first century of existence. So we are really living in unprecedented times thanks to what the Fed has done.
You know, Chris, I will say that as I followed this era over the last 12 years, I was one that felt, well, they must be in a position where they had to do this, and I was kind of okay with it until I read your book. And now it's, and I'll warn our listeners, if they read the book, it's got some things that are very concerning about the future here, and we'll get to those a little bit later. But why did they see the need to do this in 2010? You know, we had gone through the Great Recession right after that or right before that, I'm sorry. But whatever they were, didn't Congress pass some measures to try to help get us out of that? Why did the feds feel necessary to take those measures?
Yeah, and to be clear, I really felt as you did when I started reporting this book. To the degree I ever thought about the Fed, I thought it had been a very positive force in our economy, particularly after the crash of 08. But looking at this closely and having the chance to go back particularly and read through the transcripts of the debates inside the Fed leadership's circles, really changed my point of view, and coupled with seeing the sort of side effects of what the Fed did in the real economy, really changed my view on this. So you're right. This really started in 2010. We had had the crash of 2008, 2009, and our federal government had obviously done a lot after that crash. I'm sure you remember the TARP bailout, the auto industry bailout. The federal government had stepped in and tried to repair what damage it could. But by 2010, our economy was still very, very weak. The growth was weak. In November of 2010, the Tea Party movement took over Congress. That really slowed down any action out of Congress to the point that Congress was sort of sitting on the sidelines. And that's what opened up the doorway for the Fed to say, okay, we need to go beyond what we've ever done before. We need to expand our footprint in the economy. We need to try these experiments to drive economic growth. Now, on its face, of course, a person could be really sympathetic with that argument. But when you drill down and look at what the Fed actually did and what they knew the impacts were going to be, it's very questionable. Let me put it this way. Through quantitative easing, the Fed created a lot of new money, but that money wasn't just some neutral force. When the Fed makes dollars, it doesn't create it in the checking accounts of wage earners like you and me. The Fed creates this new money on Wall Street, inside the bank accounts of these 24 select banks, and they're the usual suspects, you know, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs. But when the Fed created all this money and supercharged the banking system, the Fed knew that the primary effect of this was going to be stoking up asset prices. They were going to be stoking up the price of stocks, bonds, and delivering more money into the banking system, and they hoped that it would sort of have this secondary effect of creating jobs and giving more jobs to workers. And those secondary effects were frankly really disappointing. And so what's interesting is you walk through this history and you see that the Fed knew that its policies were not creating much benefit in the short term. They knew that it would be enriching the very richest Americans and the biggest of the big banks over everybody else. And they knew that it was going to create these long-term risks, because those asset prices I just mentioned, when they get so high, frankly, as they are right now, they're unsustainable. Those prices crash again. And that's why we see so much economic volatility these days. So there are tremendous consequences to these programs at the Fed.
The way I understood this, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but they put created enormous incentives for companies to use the money. They couldn't, I mean, they couldn't dictate what they used it for, and herein lies some of the problem. And you say in the book, you don't really blame the companies because the incentives were created. And I even remember talk, and I know you remember this too, where there was talk of negative interest rates to almost force the money out, and then it was forced out, but then it created this kind of artificial asset bubbles that you're talking about.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And here's how I would put it. I would actually change that a little bit. The Fed was incentivizing and encouraging the banks to act differently. Because that's really like when the Fed tries to intervene in our economy and change things, it has to do it through the Wall Street banking system. That is changing a little bit now in 2020. But really, again, the Fed couldn't create money inside the treasury of corporations like Archer Daniels Midland or industrial conglomerate in the Midwest called Rexnord. The Fed couldn't create money for them. It could only push the banking system. And the push this had on the banking system was to create a kind of a desperate search for any kind of profit they could earn through lending. They call it a search for yield. So it encouraged the banks to extend way more cheap debt, to extend riskier and riskier loans. And that's where the companies come in. And you're exactly right. I do not blame many of these companies. I profile one of them in Milwaukee called Rexnord, which I just mentioned. And this is a firm that found that during the 2010s, it could make a lot more money packaging and selling corporate junk debt because of the way the markets were being pushed and doing these things like stock buybacks where you just borrow money and use it to buy back your stock and give that money to shareholders. These kind of speculative financial actions are exactly what the Fed is encouraging. And this, it's very important to remember, we had the dot-com crash of 1999-2000. We had the housing bubble crash of 2008. We started to have a corporate debt crash in 2020, but the Fed stopped it. And it's very easy to go back and blame the people out there in the economy, blame the greedy bankers, blame the CEOs. And of course, that's, in my view, justified. But we can't forget, many of these people are acting rationally based on the incentives the Fed's creating through very cheap debt. And the Fed is really a key element to understand why these markets keep getting wildly inflated and then crashing. And then, of course, it's the taxpayers who have to pay the price and clean up the mess when that happens.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Chris Leonard, who's the author of a new book called The Lords of Easy Money, How the Federal Reserve Broke the American Economy. It's an inside look at the Fed and its role in harming the economy, as Chris says, since 2010. We've just gotten into this, his book a little bit here. There's a local angle here that I thought was very interesting. There's a gentleman who was on the board that you profile and start the, in fact, the book kind of starts out with him, and he's originally from Fort Madison, Iowa State grad. But he was kind of like the voice in the wilderness here, warning of what was happening and the whole Fed culture. I want to talk to you about that as well, but you can talk a little bit about the gentleman here and what he was warning about. He's very prescient.
That's right. And his name is Thomas Honig. And as you say, he was born in Fort Madison, born and raised there, ended up going to a Benedictine Catholic college in Kansas, and then Tom Honig settled in Kansas City in 1972, which is when he started working for the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. He came to my attention because back in 2010, when the Fed started to go down this path of, you know, I hate to sound hyperbolic, but it's a path of radical money creation, just hyper money creation. When the Fed decided to go down that path, Thomas Honig was one of the very few leaders at the Fed who actually voted against it. When you go back and look at the debates, there was a lot of opposition to doing this. There were several leaders inside the Fed's most powerful policy committee, which is called the FOMC, or Federal Open Markets Committee. There were a lot of people inside of that committee who were saying, this is very risky. We should not be doing this. This has a lot of long-term consequences, and once we start doing this, it's going to be extremely hard to stop. Those criticisms all turned out to be accurate. But Thomas Honig, the Kansas City Fed president, was the only guy who actually voted against it and who tried to go out publicly and say, look, folks, he called these programs a deal with the devil because of the long-term costs that they would exact and the ways that they would widen the gap between the very, very richest Americans and everybody else. And again, this is like I call him a small C conservative guy. And And he was warning so vehemently against this. And I think the reason was that he had been at the Fed for so long that he had watched these cycles over the decades, from the great inflation of the 1970s to the dot-com crash to the housing market crash. And he was very familiar with the dangers of overreach at the Fed and the dangers of easy money. And he really staked his career on voting no. And when you go back and look at what he said, I think it's very fair to say his warnings all turned out to be accurate.
Let me play devil's advocate here. I guess I look at this, and I'm agreeing with you, but this period we're covering, is everybody knows, is a period of intense political polarization. We see it every day. And this is where some argue it started earlier than 2010, but 2010 is as good a date as any, because that's when the Tea Party movement gained strength. The Fed took this action because they felt Congress either didn't do enough or wasn't going to take enough action. Can't you say, what was the alternative? Would the economy have kept getting worse and perhaps had another recession in the early 2010s? Can't you look at this and say, well, maybe they did the right thing because Congress wasn't going to act and somebody had to do something?
I think that is a brilliant point and a great argument. And let me please respond to it. But first I want to say, like, one of the points of this book is exactly that, which is that as the democratic institutions, small d democratic institutions, I mean, like, the institutions in America that are controlled by voters, Congress, the White House, state legislatures, when those institutions become paralyzed, we rely more and more on these institutions that are kind of non-democratic or insulated from voters. I'm thinking the Supreme Court to mediate our policy disputes, the military to handle our foreign affairs, and the Federal Reserve to handle our economic affairs. And one thing I'm trying to point out here is that's not workable. It's not good. The Fed is not a good tool to drive economic growth. But I think your bigger question, your more pointed question is, okay, fine, you know, make that argument, but this is how reality really was back in the 2010s. Was the Fed supposed to simply sit on its hands and do nothing? And of course there's a lot of rationale to that argument, but let me tell you what changed my view on this, which is going back and reading through the actual debates when you realized what the Fed did and what it knew the consequences would be. Listen, we all knew in 2010, the Fed knew better than anybody, that economic growth was going to be very, very weak after the crash of 08 for a very long time. That there's sort of this, what they call the debt hangover from a financial crisis like that. And so it wasn't a surprise to anybody in 2010 that growth was weak. And critically, growth was returning to the U.S. economy at that time. And the senior leaders at the Fed, according to these debate transcripts, they didn't think we were headed toward a recession. What they wanted to do was step in and drive growth, to step in and accelerate the pace of growth. But again, look at what they knew the consequences would be, that really all they were going to be doing was pumping money into Wall Street through quantitative easing, giving $600 billion to 24 banks on Wall Street to push riskier investments and cheaper debt. You have people inside the Fed saying the tiny gains we get in unemployment, in job creation, they thought that this program at first would lower the unemployment rate by only 0.03%. And so that's a tiny gain for the risk of pumping up these asset bubbles. But for me, again, the real turning moment came after that in 2012, when the Fed really just quadrupled down on this kind of theory, on this kind of philosophy. When the Fed did the biggest round of quantitative easing in history in 2012, that's when you saw that the Fed knew the risks of this program were growing. And you just got to ask this question. Okay, fine, you think Congress isn't acting, but do you really think the best way to push economic growth is to hypercharge the banking system and drive up the stock market and give this money to the banks? I argue that that's not good policy.
Share with our listeners, if you will, as you do in the book, some of the ways in which these actions have increased inequality. That's an issue that we hear about a lot about now. I think people grasp that, you know, a lot of the big banks were bailed out back in 2008, 2009, TARP and all, and the wealthy have made out pretty well on this. What are some ways it impacts people at the local level? And you describe a gentleman in particular in the book that I thought displayed what happens at the local level by folks very well.
Yeah. You're talking about, I think, John Feltner.
Yes.
There. Yeah, your classic old school labor union guy who worked at a very sophisticated ball bearing plant in Indianapolis. And ball bearing sounds simple, but they made this super engineered kind of stuff that you put in airplanes. What I admired so much about this guy, John Feltner, is he's that kind of guy who's up for anything, in the sense that, yeah, he lives in a volatile economy where you can be laid off, but, I mean, he drove overnight 15 hours from Texas to Indianapolis to do the job interview to get this factory job that he had. He's, you know, you see so many workers like that around America just willing to do whatever it takes. But when you look at the full economic landscape of 2010, people like that were not well served at all by these policies. And I'll give you two ways that people were, well, shoot, I'll give you three ways people were hurt by this. The first is that just mechanically, when you do a thing like this, quantitative easing, money pumping into Wall Street, the Fed knew the way this would work is to pump up asset prices, pump up stock prices, bond prices. And the Fed thought, oh, if we do that, we'll see the so-called wealth effect that'll spill over to normal people. Well, in the United States of America, the wealthiest 1% of the population owns 40% of all the assets. And the bottom half of us, wage earners, the bottom half wealth-wise of all Americans owns only 5% of all the assets. So when you have a program that's an asset-first policy that's pumping up asset prices, you're necessarily enriching the very, very top people who really own most of the stocks and bonds. So first of all, that's how it was driving the wedge between the rich and everybody else. That's why wealth just part of why wealth just exploded at the top. But then for a guy like John Feltner in Indianapolis, you really see how these programs distorted activity in the real economy. You know, I profile how the CEOs at his company, the leadership team, just spent all of their energy and time doing financial magic that was encouraged by 0% interest rates and all this cash. They would borrow more and more money by selling corporate junk debt through Credit Suisse. And there was a bottomless appetite for corporate junk debt like that because what the Fed was doing, for about a decade, this company, Rexnord, was paying more money in interest expenses on this debt than they earned in profit. And then the firm would borrow money and use it to buy back shares of stock, which made the owners a lot of money. But it loaded down this company with debt, and predictably what the firm did was it looked at ways to slash costs. And they ended up, you know, not just suppressing wages, but eventually closing down the factory where this guy, John Feltner, worked, moving the production to a lower labor cost environment in Mexico, and left this guy without a job. So, you know, the third way, finally, is that, you know, you really couldn't save money in this environment. Interest payments on actual savings were very low. So I think it's very clear that the very richest people benefited a lot, and the rest of us out here who earn a living through a paycheck, we're living in an economy that rewarded work much less and was much more volatile.
There's so much more here. We've only got a couple minutes left. I feel like we've only touched on just the highlights of the book. There's a lot more, and I encourage our listeners to go get a copy because it's really worthwhile. It changed my view on things, and I think it'll open other eyes of people that'll read it. But my final question, I want to give you a couple minutes to answer, but You talk a lot about the Fed culture, which was interesting, and it was like only people with economic degrees can understand this, which is so condescending. But the chairman now is Jay Powell, and you describe a Wizard of Oz role, which I thought was kind of appropriate. But the big fear here that you put out is that the Fed has used all these extraordinary powers. And what if we had something come up? Would they be able to take actions again to help stimulate the economy like they've done in the past with interest rates being kept low so far? They're trying to disengage right now. They've tried it before and it hasn't worked. It's kind of a tricky, uncertain future we're looking at.
Yeah, and I hate to say it, but I actually feel like, well, I don't feel. My reporting makes me feel like we are in a very fragile and volatile position right now. And it's because the risks of what the Fed has done are really coming home to roost. I show how the Fed tried to pull back on this money printing and 0% interest rates. They tried to pull back several times, starting in 2016, but they really couldn't because markets would fall every time the Fed kind of removed this extraordinary stimulus. So here we are in 2022. We've got price inflation running at the highest level since 1982, and it's really forcing the Fed to try to pull back the stimulus again. But when it does, the price tag has only gotten much larger. There are all these assets out there that have been overpriced, corporate debt, stocks, tech stocks, you name it. So, again, this is a case of the bills coming due. It was one of the things people warned about in 2010 and 2012. And if we'd had a more moderate path back then, we wouldn't be facing these costs today. So, yeah, we're in a pretty fragile position, and the Fed is really kind of feeling its way through a dark room on this, trying to figure out which way to go forward.
Well, it's an outstanding book, and again, it's called The Lords of Easy Money, How the Federal Reserve Broke the American Economy. It changed my thinking on it, and I think folks out there that are interested in this institution and its impact on our lives would do well to pick this up. Chris Leonard's been the author, has been our guest today, and Chris, I want to thank you a lot. It's excellent book, and I look forward to having you back at some point after I read your book. Go back and read your previous book on the meat racket.
I would be delighted. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Are you ready?
You got this, girl.
Love Girls, the podcast, is all about storytelling and empowerment.
Our mission is to share a space for women and girls to talk about the stuff that matters to them most. Love speaks to the support we give each other as we search for our own path to success.
L, we can lead the way.
O,
overcome barriers.
V,
value each other.
E,
and empower each other. That's love.
Because every girl has a story.
And our stories matter.
Hey, this is Matt.
And I'm Joy.
Have you ever wondered what it'd be like to be a high-powered attorney, marketing guru, or entrepreneur?
If you have, we have a podcast just for you, and it's a real piece of work.
Come on, Joy, it's not that bad.
No, Matt, that's the name, A Real Piece of Work. It's the new job podcast for young people from WVIK and Junior Achievement of the Heartland.
Oh, nice.
Join us for A Real Piece of Work and get a jump start on your future.